You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, home of McFog the Dog.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about bozo eruptions.
But I'm also in favor of public hangings, so I think they need to bring that back.
I kind of agree. I want the guillotine, I think.
You want the guillotine? No, I want the public hanging because it's longer.
Why do so many of the people who run for public office turn out to be bozos? No, really, there's an answer as to why, and we're going to tell you what it is. Wait for that.
We begin tonight with a bombshell development in Windsor-Tecumseh Lakeshore. A city councillor who had hoped to represent the Conservatives is now off the ballot after CTV News uncovered controversial comments he made on a podcast.
A Liberal candidate has dropped out of the federal campaign. Paul Chang, a Liberal MP running for re-election, told a Chinese language newspaper, quote, "To everyone here, you can claim the $1 million Hong Kong bounty if you bring Conservative candidate Zhou Tay to Toronto's Chinese consulate."
Andrew Lawton was a member of what's described as a clandestine group chat called Freedom Rights Movement. It includes more than 50 names associated with the Freedom Convoy and the Canadian far right.
In 2004, Member of Parliament Cheryl Gallant compared abortion to the beheading of American journalist Nick Berg only a week after it happened.
The National Post is reporting Loyola was booted shortly after they asked the Liberals for comment on a 2009 rap video where Loyola praises Lebanon's Hezbollah and the Palestinian militant group Hamas.
A week before Mark Carney called the current election, the Liberal Party of Canada did not have candidates nominated in almost half of the ridings in Canada. The Conservatives as well, they had spots yet to fill. And the NDP, well, they still needed 126 candidates. I want you to think about that for a second. Imagine that's you, like, it's your job. You've got a week to nail down 80, 100 warm bodies to run for office, and every one of them needs to be somebody who will not humiliate you on the campaign trail. And then, perhaps as a distant secondary concern, you know, they should probably be people who are fit to serve in Parliament. So now we're in the campaign. Most, not all, of those slots have been filled. And surprise, surprise, some of the people who they found to fill them are turning out to be bozos. Why do the parties end up with so many low-quality candidates? Maybe, and just hear me out here, maybe it's because being a member of parliament is a job. I mean, even when they can find somebody who is talented and smart and motivated and principled, well, how much of that do they even get to express or use on a job where their every vote, even their every word, is being handed down from central command? I want to read you something. Canadians often see politicians as little more than trained SEALs who vote on command and repeat robotic talking points. Politicians are brand ambassadors, and party loyalty usually wins out in Canada. So according to the guy who wrote that, a Canadian politics professor from out east named Alex Marland, our big political parties act like cartels that demand total obedience from their members. They come up with marketing messages at headquarters, and then the candidates are expected to simply parrot those messages out on the campaign trail. And if they win and become MPs, they are whipped, meaning they are expected to vote as a bloc. And anyone who strays from the party line or votes in a different direction will get sidelined, shunned, shuffled, backbenched, maybe dropped completely from caucus. Now, when you consider all of that, and you add it to the other fun stuff that comes with a life in politics, the name-calling, the dirt-slinging, the partisan nastiness, the loss of privacy, the harassment from the public, the social media posts about you and your kids, all of that, add it up, And who would even want that job? Except a bozo. How did things get like this to begin with? Well, Professor Alex Marland has been trying to figure that out. He has written books about it, Brand Command, Whipped, and his new book, No I in Team, Party Loyalty in Canadian Politics. This is what he studies, how things got this bad in Canadian politics. And Professor Alex Marland of Acadia University joins me from Wolfville, Nova Scotia, in a minute. Wait for it.
My name is Alex Marland. I'm the Jaroslawski Chair in Trust and Political Leadership at Acadia University in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. I talk to politicians and I try to understand some of the things that go on behind the scenes in Canadian politics.
Alex, I like to remind people that a few months back the Liberals asked me to run for them in this election in the Eglinton-Lawrence riding. The reason that I bring this up so often is because I'm vain and egotistical and insecure. I feel validated by the fact that they asked me, and I wanted to reflect positively on me, even though I turned them down. This was not a good idea for them. I am not a good choice for them. I do not deserve this opportunity. I have no training or experience in politics that makes me qualified. All I have to offer is a small amount of name recognition, and it's not even positive name recognition. So I think that it reveals something about just like how frantically they were looking for anybody to run for them back in January when they approached me. But imagine if I had said yes, because their fortunes have reversed entirely. I would be like a shoo-in. I would be looking at a new career in Ottawa as a member of federal parliament, which is just terrifying. Let's do a hypothetical here. In this hypothetical universe where I actually said yes to them, let's imagine that I'm better than I am. Let's imagine that the reason why I said yes is because I really want to serve. I want to represent my community. I want to make things better. And that I'm a different kind of candidate with new independent ideas, but they're the right ideas for my constituents. So let's imagine that that's me, a better me, and I said yes to the Liberals. What would happen next?
What would have happened in your case, Jesse, is you would have had to fill out a 30 to 50 page form outlining everything in your life, your name, your background, where you've lived, the jobs you've had, criminal convictions, bankruptcies, divorces. They even ask about plagiarism. And I bring this up because of some of the allegations involving Mark Carney and his PhD thesis. That's an example of the kind of things that they want to avoid.
Did they miss it with Carney? I guess he was never accused back when he was doing his PhD.
Well, the reason why these things get missed a lot of the time, I mean, Justin Trudeau in blackface is another example, right? I mean, here's one of the most high-profile people in Canada, and nobody knows about blackface until well after he's prime minister. And what this does is it tells us that a lot of what they're looking for is often relatively surface. The people I've interviewed say they mostly focus on what you've posted on social media, and they also look at the first 10 pages of returns on a Google search. So anything deeper than that, they just don't have the time or resources to get into. And the thing to keep in mind in all this is, why are they doing this? Why are they scrutinizing you so much? The first thing is that they don't want something to emerge in the middle of an election campaign. They don't want journalists or other people to suddenly say, hey, look at this person. Look at all the bad things that they've done. But the second thing is that it's actually your opponents who are researching the candidates. And what they're doing is they're finding out information. It's called opposition research, or OPPO. And they're collecting this information and they have it ready to go. And they time it on purpose to make as much trouble and mayhem and mischief as possible. So what they'll do, Jesse, so let's say you had become this candidate and you actually did have some skeletons in your closet and another party finds out about it. They would have waited until Mark Carney came and visited you, or you was in the Toronto area, you're on stage with him, and Carney's making this big announcement that they've worked all sorts of time to announce policy, and boom, all of a sudden on all these journalists' phones appears, Jesse did this. And now that's the questions that Carney would have had to answer. So it's a real destabilizing moment in the campaign, and they don't want any of it, so they try to avoid these problems.
Yeah, they're called Bozo eruptions. I knew that Oppo research is held in reserve and released strategically. It never occurred to me that they wait until, like, all right, there's some minor candidate who's got some skeleton in his closet. Let's wait until our real target touches him, and that's when we'll set off this bomb. It's a dirty business, but maybe it's good because, I mean, yes, this is done by rival political parties to thwart their opponents in the form of Oppo research, but we do it. We just launched a new series where my colleague Sam is vetting candidates. I mean, this is in the public interest that we know who wants our vote. We know who we're putting into office. I think that we should be vetting our candidates. Do you feel like our politics have suffered since we started to scrutinize political candidates so closely?
Depends on how much you believe in cancel culture. Right. If you're somebody who thinks that everybody who goes into a legislature should have an impeccable background, an impeccable record, sure, you'll end up with a sort of virtuous public assembly. But is that really democracy? Do we end up with a legislature where everybody can understand all the problems of the world and the people they're meant to represent? Sometimes it's actually helpful to have people who have difficult life experiences that they have learned from.
Okay, so let's assume that our hypothetical candidate here survives the 50-page interrogation, the vetting, they sidestep any possible Bozo eruptions. Their secrets remain secrets, or maybe they don't have any. Maybe they're bland enough, and they actually get elected. What happens next? What happens in caucus? Like, how is the power of central command exercised from day to day?
Honestly, the more you learn about it, the more it gets kind of dark and scary a little bit. Like, even though these are not bad people, but ultimately just the system in itself has turned into a monster that most of us don't know much about. So caucus is when there is a meeting of members of the legislature from the same political party. So caucus meetings happen in camera. It happens away from the public. It's meant to be a forum where you can say whatever you want without any fear of reprisal. And so what will often happen is people will say, don't say things in public, say it in caucus if you have a problem. That's where you can talk to the leader. That's where you can talk to us. That's where we can hash things out. And that used to be true, because what has happened is we now see that political staff are increasingly in these meetings. And political staff are really important people. They do so much, but the world is so fast-paced now, you can't operate without them. And leaders have this gaggle of staff around them. And what would happen is when Brian Mulroney was prime minister, he wouldn't have staff with him and he would just have meetings directly with MPs and they loved him for it. But then he would walk out with all these little sticky notes saying, I made all these commitments, and staff would have to go figure it out. But instead now there's gatekeepers. And what started happening under Paul Martin and it happened under Stephen Harper is the chief of staff was present. Well, now the chief of staff has the ear of the prime minister. You know the chief of staff is monitoring what you're doing. You want to be promoted. You want to become a minister. You want a better portfolio. You want to become an opposition critic, etc. You know that person is watching what you're doing. Under Justin Trudeau, it ended up being a whole bunch of staff who were in the room. And more than that, staff now have roles. Staff now will be giving presentations. They will show examples of social media posts that went viral, and then they will put this up and say, hey, MP so-and-so did this thing. Hey, look at everyone. Look at how great this person is on social media promoting our message. And everybody now is basically being told, listen, fall in line, parrot the messaging, and you will get rewarded.
Canadians cannot afford to pay anymore. And that's why my common sense plan is to axe the tax.
I support the axe the tax initiative that the federal conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, has been asking for.
After 8 years, we've gone from feasting to scrap. So for Christmas, will they finally axe the tax?
It's incredible how much staff have a strong presence. And this creates a chilling effect. It means that if you are a parliamentarian, you have to be careful what you're saying in caucus meetings, which brings up the question, where is it that you can express disagreement?
So they're being spied on, even in their kind of inner sanctum when there's a caucus meeting, and it's like this is the reserved spot where you can actually dissent or disagree. Somebody, as an agent of the prime minister, is there watching to see who's loyal and who's causing trouble, and then that could have all kinds of repercussions for you.
Yeah, and it's more than that, because it's actually your peers are all jockeying against you because they all want to be seen in a favorable light. So they will find ways to make you look bad. But even when you mention the word spying, when I think about that, that actually gets to even ministers' offices, because ministers often don't get to pick their own staff. It's the prime minister's office who's involved in putting staff in ministers' offices. So again, we have this tentacle coming out of the leader's office, making sure that everybody is falling in line. There's good reasons why they do it, but it obviously has some democratic implications.
Well, not everybody who is part of a caucus or even part of cabinet follows the party line, and there is progress. We saw cabinet where somebody like Jody Wilson-Raybould, not only a woman, but an Indigenous woman, incredible, inspirational success story, completely different than Canadians had been used to in Ottawa, rose to be a part of Trudeau's cabinet, and she didn't toe the party line.
She did. She did until she didn't.
3 years since, Jody Wilson-Raybould has gone from PMO poster child to its biggest worry. Wilson-Raybould does not appear to be afraid to publicly criticize her political masters. Wilson-Raybould was called difficult and self-centered by unnamed liberal sources in the media.
One of the things that she talks about, and I've interviewed her for some of my research, is just how much of a team mentality there is, how much pressure there is on you to always go along with the leader. And so in her particular case, she was doing that up until she was resisting about the whole SNC-Lavalin affair and things related to her ability as a minister to act individually. But eventually she hit the chopping block, right? She got kicked out of the Liberal Party, her and Jane Philpott. And a lot of the reason they got kicked out was because they were seen as not towing the party line.
I was being a little facetious there because, of course, she was individualistic, not in that she had some social media post or had a bozo eruption, but because she took a principled stand. I think about this a lot, actually. It cost her her political career, right? And in some other universe where the prime minister can have ministers and MPs who can differ with him and can have debates even in public, she survives that moment and could be the leader of the Liberal Party right now. But that was an impossibility in the case of Jody Wilson-Raybould, unless she was willing to suck it up and follow the leader, not in a small matter, but in a matter of really basic principle as to whether or not the law should be equally applied, whether or not the Attorney General should be independent from the political considerations of the PMO, and whether the law should apply to big companies like SNC-Lavalin. She thought that they should be independent, and she thought that the law should be independently applied, and she will never be prime minister.
She had one major accomplishment after all that, and that was in the 2019 election, she did manage to get elected as an independent.
Alex, how do independents do in Canadian politics?
They usually don't do well, to put it mildly. I have looked at all of the candidates since 1972 up to today. If we were to take the number of people federally and provincially who the first time ran as an independent, so they hadn't been elected and then left a party, they just simply got elected on their own name, you'd be able to fit them in a car. There's five people since 1972 who have pulled that off. And it's an incredibly rare feat for that to happen.
That seems really important because independent of that information about independence, we could chalk this up to a problem with our system and the way that it differs from, say, the American system. There's room for mavericks in the Senate. There's room for mavericks in Congress. They are elected independently. You can vote for a maverick locally who you like and then vote for your preferred presidential candidate. You can't do that in Canada. You might love somebody locally who's an independent, but, you know, Canadians are mostly focused and our media attention is mostly focused on the federal race. And just the way our system is set up, where one kind of is the proxy for the other, we could blame it all on that system. But I don't think you can, right? Because even when people have the choice, they don't take it.
You could look at other parliamentary systems. You could look at Britain as a point of comparison, say, well, you know what? Their electoral system is reasonably the same. Obviously, they use a similar system of government. They're the ones who initiated it. They have multiple political parties. Like, there's a lot of things that are similar. And yet, for some reason, we're the ones over here that elect a bunch of people that if you go out of line, you are seen as out of order, and you are potentially somebody who is not going to get the opportunity to run again with that party. But even before that, there's all sorts of other sanctions that have started emerging. And the number one sanction that seems to happen from all the people I've interviewed, it's the hidden stuff that we don't see. And what it is it's almost like the high school equivalent of social ostracization. If you start rocking the boat, other members in your party give you a hard time. And they say, well, you are making us look bad. Knock it off. You are causing problems for us. Get in line. I've had multiple MPs tell me that if they do something, they will be walking along in Ottawa. They will be walking along in the corridors of Parliament. They will have staff and other parliamentarians from their party look at them and turn around and walk in the other direction. Now, maybe they're making this up in their mind. Maybe the person's turning around because they forgot their phone back in their office. The bottom line is they think this is what's going on. And it's just simply a complete control over their minds and what it is that they can say.
Hello? If someone says something bad about you, you'd want me to tell you, right?
What do you... Hold on, other line.
Hello? Let's go out. Don't invite Gretchen. She's driving me nuts.
It's Regina. Regina says everyone hates you because you're such a... She said that? You didn't hear it from me.
There's like a fundamental question here. Like, there are good reasons why they do it. So we could blame them for being controlling, and we can cast them. You know, the leaders are muzzling their own people. They're whipping them. All of the terminology is very, I don't know, dramatic and evocative of, like, tight control of this authoritarian rule. But it's organically grown around our system. So what might empower an MP to say, like, to hell with this? But like in the American system, somebody like AOC, they can say, my power does not come from me being in favor with the Democratic Party, with the party leader, with the party leadership. My power comes from the people who voted for me. So to hell with you. I'm going to speak my mind. And by doing so, I can push this party in different directions because my mandate comes from the people. That is not our system here. So the parties are actually just arguably fitting their mechanisms to what actually serves our system better. It's not good to have a maverick. It doesn't help you if there's a strategically timed bozo eruption at the time that you need it worst. They're just doing the best they can with the rules that everybody's playing by.
Yeah. Why is it that it's so newsworthy when somebody in a political party says something that's totally different than the leader? As a society in Canada, we treat that as though it's deceit and it's treachery. And yet sometimes it's frankly helpful.
What is the danger of a leader who demands that kind of absolute loyalty? The danger is that that puts all of the pressure on them being right. And if a leader loses touch with what is right, if a leader loses touch even with like their own electability, where they are sure that they can win, even though the writing is on the wall that they cannot win, and everybody knows it, and everybody knows that they're going to lose their job, all of that leader's MPs, who might I be talking about here? This happened where the demand for absolute loyalty by Justin Trudeau, there was finally countervailing pressure, which is, well, what does it matter if I follow Trudeau, if I'm following him off a cliff? And the question came up within the Liberal government from all of these different MPs. Who's going to do something about this? Who's going to tell this guy? Like, he doesn't seem to know.
The breaking news has just come from Finance Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, that she, in fact, is no longer going to be Finance Minister and indeed is resigning from the cabinet.
It really is remarkable to me that the good soldier who was the most loyal, Chrystia Freeland, by the rules of Canadian politics and by Justin Trudeau's rules, was loyal up until the point where she saved all of their asses, didn't she? We can see that looking back, that she pulled him back right at the last minute and saved the jobs of her colleagues. Without her actions, he would not have announced his resignation. So she had the political acumen to know when that loyalty had run its course. And then she got trounced.
The next Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, with 131,674 votes, representing 85.9% of the vote.
And here's the point I want to make, what I think that illustrates is that we can blame the system all we want, but ultimately, Liberal Party members chose Carney by an incredibly, like a devastating, embarrassing margin. And they were right in terms of electability. Is there not a bottom line where it's the Canadian public? Because we can look, as you say, at the differences between the Canadian and American system. We can blame it on the system. But there are other systems like ours that somehow make room for more independent thought amongst candidates and that actually value and prize somebody who will take a bold independent stand and stray from the party leader. But not in Canada, because there's no question to my mind or to the mind of Liberal Party members that Mark Carney, who has no history of independent, maverick departure, and who is much more of a traditional candidate, and he was never disloyal, which is something that I have heard people judge Chrystia Freeland for.
I think that something we're thinking about more broadly is, why is it that we have not heard, at least I haven't seen it, we haven't heard discourse going on about how is it that all of these Liberal MPs easily going along with massive changes in public policy and not raising a stink about it? I mean, wouldn't you have thought that there would be at least one Liberal out there who would have taken a stand over the end of the carbon tax? I mean, this is something they were campaigning on, and they were saying this is absolutely the way forward. How is it that nobody is so principled to say, I'm not going to stand for this, I can't be part of this party anymore? It's just shocking to me. It just tells me, like, what kind of principled people are we electing? When surely somebody should have said, I'm not going to run again. The reasons I'm not running again is because I don't agree on policy. I wasn't hearing that. Big question to me in all of these things is, you know, at what point do we want to have candidates and do we want to have politicians who aren't afraid to take on things that they disagree with and do it in a way that is respectful and yet at the same time disruptive?
Can I share a complaint, not as a citizen in a high-minded way about the quality of candidates and legislators and couldn't they be better, but like a selfish complaint as a podcast host? Our politicians are so boring. They are so constrained. There's so many personalities in American politics or British politics, like people who are just like really interesting to hear them talk, characters. It's interesting to hear them debate. They might tell jokes. They might hear, we get an MP into the studio and it's almost impossible to get them off of message track. Like, they are terrified of speaking like a normal human being. Beyond our frustrations of it's hard to get information out of them, it's hard to make interesting political content. That's my selfish consideration, because it affects more Canadians following American politics than Canadian politics. And that has an effect on our democracy, in that people are less engaged in Canada because it's less fun and interesting to hear our politicians speak with each other and speak to journalists.
Yeah, and I would add, actually, it creates an opening for populists. Because, you know, for me, I think of Ontario Premier Doug Ford. I mean, it is really refreshing to hear him every now and then talk in a way that most politicians don't.
Sure. You have two choices here, folks. We roll over as a country and just let them run over us, or we fight like hell, like we've never fought before. I'm taking option two. If they want to try to annihilate Ontario, I will do everything, including cut off their energy, with a smile on my face. So, and I'm encouraging every other province to do the same.
Sometimes populists can be good, and sometimes they, you know, we've seen in different parts of the world, sometimes they can be a force for bad. So I think one of the challenges with having plastic politicians who repeat message tracks is it does create openings for people, because the public gets really tired of it. They tune them out. They have no interest in it, and brings down trust in politicians and trust in our political institutions overall.
Alex, thank you.
My pleasure.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. You can email me about this show at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Max Collins is our director of audio. I'm the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different